Good morning. Welcome. Good to see you this morning. As you came in today, I hope you picked up a button. I got mine at the early service, and we'll say more about what these buttons mean later. But right now, I just kind of invite you to hold it, to feel the tactile sense of it. You know, we live in this world of ideas, and sometimes it's helpful to hold on to things. A symbol, if you will, of hope, if you wish. A sense of meaning, where we're from. So you can hold on to that. If you wish to keep this button and take it with you at the end of the day, feel free to do so. Some folks like that tactile reminder, and you can take this home and put it on your shelf with your other little things like that. I got one of those. Maybe you do too. If you rather just keep the idea and let the object go, you can return it to the little plastic basket that'll be at the door on your way out. And the more buttons that are returned, the less of Kimberly's supply of buttons I'll need to replace. But if you want to take it with you, please do. It's all fine. They're not expensive to do so. So I didn't tell her that I was going to borrow her buttons this morning. She's not here. So hold on to that. Just as long as I have breath, I will sing yes to life and love and truth, just as long as I have breath. And sometimes that's easy, right? Beautiful day, all is well, we sing yes to life and love and truth, no problem. Other days it's harder. It's harder. We pay attention to the world. The tragedies of the world intrude upon our awareness and our consciousness. We wake up to what is happening. Some days it's harder to say yes to life and love and truth. But we sing anyway, because it is in that assertion of hope and the possibility of love that lies our salvation. Not our individual salvation from some personal fate, the salvation of our world that we share together. When we give up, it's over. When we say there is more than vengeance and pain, then there is hope. There is love and the possibility of redemption and forgiveness and progress and peace. So we sing when it's hard, just as loudly, with as much vigor and hope and strength as when it is easy. Let's rise in body or spirit. Turn to those standing around you and say good morning. Let's sing together our hymn for the month of November. What gift can we bring? What present? What token? Please be seated. The flaming chalice is the symbol of our faith, a beacon of truth, a fire for justice, and a warmth for the soul. As I light the chalice, let us speak together the covenant of our church. We gather for worship this morning. Breathe in and out. Hold on to your talisman if you wish. You are held here in this place, whether you are new with us today or have been coming here for longer than anybody remembers. You are held here by this place and these people and this tradition, which lives and breathes in and through us, in the midst of joy and the midst of sorrow. My colleague Sean Neil Barron wrote these words Friday night for this morning. There are not enough candles in the world. If we were to light one for each death, there are not enough candles in this world. For each man gunned down, for each trans person attacked, for every woman left battered, for every child caught in the crossfire, for every family starved by sanctions, for every militant massacred. If each time this happened, we all gathered together, massing, converging on town square and common green, an internet chat room lit only by the faint dancing light of a candle, together lamenting, together rejoicing in the life that still lives, there wouldn't be enough candles. At first, there would be runs on the stores to buy them. a new practice taken up with vigor, shelves left bare. Determined remembrance for each departed. At first. After a while, though, it would just be another item to buy on the grocery list. Every night gathering together to read yet another set of names. Each night would bleed into the next. Even still, there are not enough candles. Part of me wishes we would engage in this lament. Part of me wishes those who sell the guns, who breathe the hate, and who make the weapons and pass the policies and deploy the troops and utter racist words would all be there. That slowly the names would smooth away the rationalizations, the false projections, the twisted logic, the false hopes, the idealistic dreams that all dwell within the violence. But I know there are not enough candles in the world. We come this day in sorrow and in grief. Violence visits down the street, across the world, in places known to us well and in places we have never heard of. Lives lost in violence, those who claim faith but have lost it, in hatred. Those who wish for power but forget mercy. Those who live in rage without compassion. We long for the pain which is in each of us to be turned toward mercy and understanding and away from vengeance and control. We so wish it for the world. We know it is our only way. And yet we mourn for every time it does not happen, where rage leads only to rage and pain. We come here with our longing, and we know, too, that is not the only story. There is pain and there is tragedy. It's true. And there is beauty and there is wonder. And there is days in the middle of November we have not earned and do not deserve. And there is love and music and hope and poetry, and all that is good is still true. It is so much to hold it all, and we come here to be held by a tradition beyond our naming, by a love beyond our knowing, by one another, by the spirit of life. To hold it all and be held, the pain and the sorrow, the compassion and the joy, life in its fullness, to turn not off but awake, to live with hope that the spirit of our life may be with us this day and every day. So let us worship.
The spirit of my life, give me strength through stress and strife. Help me live with dignity. Let me know serenity. Fill me with a vision. Clear my mind of fear and confusion. When my thoughts flow restlessly, let peace find a home in me.
This month we are celebrating our ancestors and thinking about what it means to be a people of ancestry, to carry on those things which have been passed on to us and to build for generations to come a world of beauty and hope. We're also thinking in that context about ancestry, about this church, and about those who have left a legacy that endures for us. So how many of you knew Dorothy and Jesse Frederick? Raise your hands if you knew them. Yeah, lots of you. I never had the chance, but they have left a legacy here which is remarkable. They had a particular passion for student and intern ministry, for this congregation's role as a teaching church. And so they left from their estate a gift to support that teaching ministry for student ministers. And those ministers we've had, folks like David Kramer and Morgan McLean and Nancy McDonald and others, have benefited from that endowment, which was created by their legacy. And it's made a huge difference to Unitarian Universalism as a whole and to this church in particular. I think about Nancy McDonald, who was a student with me in seminary a few years younger, and came here and did her internship and went off to serve a church in Virginia, and now at one of our largest congregations in Maryland, and she's preaching the big service at General Assembly this summer. She's like the rock star in Unitarian Universalism, and it's because of Dorothy and Jesse Frederick that she was paid for her internship and had the chance to learn all the things she learned here. Nancy's going to come back and preach during our 175th anniversary year next year, so you'll get to see her again, as well as Mark Bellatini, who did his internship here all those years ago in the 1970s. This legacy is really important to us, and legacies like the Frederick internship make this church what it is and make our faith what it is. So in your order of service, you'll find a brochure about our legacy society. We are hoping that folks will join the society. Perhaps you are already a member because you have already committed in your will or estate or insurance policy that a legacy gift will go to the church, but you haven't told us that, so just tell us. But this is also a great time before the end of the calendar year to update your documents and to include the church in your plans, that we might too leave a legacy for generations to come. And I thank you, if you'll fill that out and turn it in, we'd be very grateful. You'd be a founding member of the Legacy Society if we get it by the end of the year. So that's part of the story about the church. And part of the story about the church is welcoming new people among us, which we do about every 3 months or so. We have a ceremony. Some folks are coming during the week, and some can be here on Sunday. We're so glad to have them. So I'm going to invite Belle Larson, our membership coordinator, to say a little bit about what the folks officially joining as members today have done and how this works.
So at this time, we would like the folks who are joining our congregation to come forward. Everyone who you'll see up here today has attended our Path to Membership class, and they found our congregation to be of value to their lives. They've pledged to give of their time and financial resources to our community. So please join me in welcoming these folks now and in Deal Hall after the service. And for any of our guests here who are interested in learning more about Unitarian Universalism and our congregation, our next Intro to UU class will be January 20th, and the sign-up is out in the narthex on the sign-up table, so have a peek if you're interested.
So I'm going to invite each of these folks to come up here and tell you their name, and we'll respond with these words. We welcome you to the covenant of our community. We are a covenantal community bound by our promises to one another. And they'll receive a gift and sign the membership book. And then afterwards, we'll give them a round of applause and be sure to say hi to them after this service.
Bruce White Wolf.
Welcome to the covenant of our community.
Ellen Ammer.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Will Belke.
Welcome to the covenant of our community.
We're so glad to have these folks among us. And while they finish signing the book and get their gifts, I want to start telling you a story. We're talking today about where do we come from? Who are we? And part of who we are is being held in a community together, and part of who we are is our families and where we come from. So that's what we're talking about today. And so Kimberly found this great story, which I'm sure that you will all enjoy, about where do we come from? It's called The Baby Tree. After I wake up, And after I get out of bed, and after I wake up Dad, and wake up Mom, and wake up Dad again, and after I get dressed and feed the cat, we have breakfast. After breakfast, Mom and Dad tell me they're going to tell me some news. And then they tell me the news. A new baby is coming. I have 100 questions in my head, but the only one that comes out is, are there any more Cocoa Pups? And because Mom and Dad are all happy about the baby coming, they let me have a second helping of Cocoa Pops, and I make sure it's a big one. Then I think of what I really want to know, which is, where are we going to get the baby? But now Dad's running late, and Mom's running really late, and all of us at the door to walk me to school. I like Olive because she's a teenager, and she knows lots of stuff, and she doesn't make me hold her hand unless I want to, but I usually want to. So I tell her about the baby, and I ask her if she knows where babies come from. She says, sure, you plant a seed, and it grows into a baby tree. And then we're at my classroom. It's a busy morning, and so I don't think much about the baby tree. Until after play and snack and rest and reading time, and then when we have art. I try to paint the baby tree, but it doesn't look right. So I ask Miss McClure if she knows where babies come from. From the hospital, she says. And then she says, boys and girls, it's time to wash our brushes. I know for a fact that you only go to the hospital when you break your leg or when you have something taken out. Grandpa had stones inside him, and he had them taken out, and he keeps them in the jar to show me. I'll ask Grandpa where babies come from. He'll know. It's a while before we go to see Grandpa, and before I can ask him anything, we have to go up on the roof to visit the pigeons. When we've let out the polite ones and are watching them fly around and around in the sky, I ask Grandpa, Grandpa, where do babies come from? And Grandpa tells me, a stork brings your baby in the night and leaves it in a bundle on your doorstep. I check the doorstep every morning before breakfast, but there are no babies, only the mail. Roberto, the mailman, thinks babies come from eggs, but he doesn't know where to get the eggs. I am very confused. After dinner, and after my bath, and after my bedtime story, and after my second bedtime story, I tell Mom and Dad I have a question to ask them. I ask them, where do babies come from? From inside their mom, says Mom. They start off really tiny, says Dad. Almost too small to see, says Mom. They begin with a seed from their dad, which gets planted in an egg inside their mom. The baby grows in there for 9 months until it runs out of room, and it's ready to be born, sometimes at home, but usually in the hospital. So Olive was right about the seed, and Roberto was right about the egg, and Mrs. McClure was right about the hospital. But Grandpa, I'm going to have to tell Grandpa where babies come from. Oh, there it is. We spend so much of our lives rushing headlong into the next moment. So I'm going to invite you to put your books and your papers off to the side, to breathe in and out, to notice the thoughts that come and go, the feelings that come and go, and just say hello as they go by, to breathe. There's so much that calls upon our attention. Already the middle of November and the holidays of one sort or another just around the corner. Seems hard to believe. Rush headlong into the next moment. Monday comes, this to do, that to do, appointments, and all that rushing around. The inbox fills. But it can wait. It really can. The future is yet to be. The past is already gone. This moment is all there is. So breathe. Be. Remember that you are enough, that this moment is enough. Breathe. And in the silence that comes, feel the power of the Spirit. My many names flow in and through you and all the beings of the world. May the spirit of life and love be with us this day and every day. Amen and blessed be. I'm going to sing together. We are. The breath of our ancestors flows through us. Let's rise in body or spirit. Please be seated. Two readings this morning. The first, a poem by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry called From Generation to Generation. In a house which becomes a home, one hands down and another takes up the heritage of mind and heart. Laughter and tears, musing and deeds. Love, like a carefully loaded ship, crosses the gulf between the generations. Therefore, we do not neglect the ceremonies of our passage when we are wed, when we die, and when we are blessed with a child, when we depart and when we return, when we plant and when we harvest. Let us bring up our children. It is not the place of some official to hand them their heritage. If others impart to our children our knowledge and ideals, they will lose all of us that is wordless and full of wonder. Let us build memories in our children, lest they drag out joyless lives, lest they allow treasures to be lost because they have not been given the keys. We live not by things, but by the meaning of things. It is needful to transmit the passwords from generation to generation. The second reading is a story by my colleague Bruce Marshall entitled A Wedding. This was the bride's first marriage. The groom had been married before and had a 12-year-old daughter. They were going to be married on the grounds of a restaurant overlooking the harbor. Getting together for pre-wedding interviews had been difficult. Appointments were broken. My calls were not returned. When they did show up, it was at different times than we had arranged. And interesting to me, all three, the bride, the groom, and the groom's daughter, came to the interviews. I was not surprised when the couple never got around to looking at the ceremonies I had sent them, didn't know what was involved in getting a license, weren't sure whether there would be a processional or anyone would serve as legal witnesses. And they said they would call me with the information I needed before the wedding. The night before, I still had not heard, and I couldn't get an answer at their phone, so I called the groom's mother. She was vague. Wedding? Oh, yes. You're the minister? No, I don't know anything more about it. By now, I doubted whether there would even be a wedding, but I decided to show up just in case. When I arrived, there were indeed guests. The bride was dressed in a traditional white gown. The groom greeted me warmly, and the groom's mother apologized for the night before. The groom's daughter had the license and made sure I got it. She also had the ceremony, which she handed to me and explained what the bride and groom had decided. It seemed normal, and in contrast to what had happened before, until I noticed snippets of conversation among the guests and realized that many of their comments had to do with drinking. "Let's get the ceremony over so we can start drinking. What a good excuse for a party. When's the bar going to open?" The people were well-dressed, attractive, and well-spoken, but their principal topic of conversation was booze. The wedding took place on the hill, overlooking the harbor, and it was a beautiful, sunny morning. The bride and the groom snickered and poked each other throughout the ceremony, which they had cut down to the minimum. While the guests also talked and laughed amongst themselves, I struggled to keep the service from becoming a farce. Only the groom's 12-year-old daughter stood there quietly, seriously, thoughtfully, as if charting her next step and what I am certain would be the essential project of her teenage years, to help, protect, and take care of these people who would be her parents.
I know they say you can't go home again. I just had to come back one last time. Ma'am, I know you don't know me from Adam, but these handprints on the front steps are mine. Up those stairs in that little back bedroom is where I did my homework and I learned to play guitar. And I bet you didn't know, under that live oak, my favorite dog is buried in the yard. I thought if I could touch this place or feel it, this brokenness inside me might start healing. Out here it's like I'm someone else. I thought that maybe I could find myself. If I could just come in, I swear I'll leave. Won't be nothing but a memory from the house that built me. Mama cut out pictures of houses for years, from Better Homes and Garden magazine. Plans were drawn and concrete poured, and nail by nail and board by board. Daddy gave life to Mom's dream. I thought if I could touch this place or feel it, this brokenness inside me might start healing. Out here it's like I'm someone else. I thought that maybe I could find myself. If I could just come in, I swear I'll leave. Won't be nothing but a memory from the house that built me. You leave home and you move on and you do the best you can. I got lost in this old world and forgot who I am. I thought if I could touch this place or feel it, This brokenness inside me might start healing. Out here it's like I'm someone else. I thought that maybe I could find myself. If I could just walk around, I swear I'll leave. Won't need nothing but a memory from the house that built me.
Every year, I become more my father. It's not just the way that we stand or laugh or the shape of our hands, it's who we are. Just like him, I'm cheap most of the time, especially on myself, but free spending on meals for friends. That's the exception. Just like my dad, nothing makes me as angry as liars or charlatans or deliberate unclarity. I have my father's taste in beer. I used to think the one thing we'd always be different about was our politics, but he's become much more liberal in his retirement, to my shock and everyone else's shock, and we're now on the same page there too. I don't have his love for golf, although maybe that'll change in time, but other than that, we're very similar. Last time I was home, I even caught myself enjoying my father's music, which was truly terrifying. But I decided quite a while ago, years now, that if I was going to be like someone, my father was a fine choice. I respect him and his life and his integrity. I think that realization was the final end to adolescence and the true beginning of adulthood. The sermon is titled, as you may have noticed, "Them That Sewed 'Em On." I had a colleague in seminary, she was from the South, she would often say, "Ain't nobody can push your buttons like them that sewed 'em on." This sermon is devoted to them that sew them on. Not just parents, but siblings and grandparents and the whole tribe of ancestors and relations who play such a big role in who we are. We religious liberals like to talk about how families come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, which is true. We talk about how family is something you can create. Our theology encourages individualism and self-determination. I myself like to quote that definition of family as a group of people who share the same life chances. Such a nice definition, so inclusive and devoted to free will, and there's something to be said for this way of thinking. We do have the power to make some choices about families, who we align ourselves with. It's good to include a variety of families and not be stuck in some narrow definition. But the problem with the usual liberal approach to families is that it does not fully account for complicated reality. The fact that fate matters. We do not choose who will sew our buttons on. This is not up to us. And we do not choose who sewed their buttons on, or theirs before that. Some things are just given. We choose how to play our hand, but we don't get to pick our cards. Those are dealt to us by history and the universe. So much of our personality is set even before we are born. We come into this network of relations, a patchwork of stories and a web of meaning. And although from our first breath we start participating in and thus recreating these relations and stories and meanings, they existed before us and they condition our possibilities. We are not their master. This is not to say we cannot go our own way, we can and often do, but no matter how much we move into our own world, we remain connected to these origins and these histories. They cannot be so easily waved away. I thought if I could touch this place, the brokenness inside me might start healing. I thought maybe I could find myself. You leave home, you move on, but you can get lost in this whole world and forget who you are. Home is a touchstone, like it or not. It reminds us of who we are, or at least who we were, which is still part of who we are. The houses that built us, the families that shape us, remain with us wherever we go. Since I left home for college, which is unbelievably to me this year, 20 years ago, since that day I've lived away. 5 hours by car for 4 years, and then in different places around the country, a 4-hour plane ride, a 3-day drive. I put a lot of miles on my car. My children have frequent flyer numbers. When I lived in Colorado Springs, Colorado, most people were in the same boat as I was. Their families lived far away. But here in Rockford, it's often different, isn't it? In Colorado Springs, people asked, "Where are you from?" And they would expect to hear things like Minnesota, Virginia, Illinois, whatever it was. In Rockford, they ask, "What high school did you go to?" I get asked all the time, "Did you go to Guilford?" "No, where'd you go?" You wouldn't have heard of it, trust me. In Colorado Springs, I remember we were talking about this. The church was about 120 members at the time, and they said, who's born here in this city? 2 of the 120 members were from there. How many of you were born within about 50 miles of Rockford, Illinois? Yeah, more than 2, right? Not everybody, but a lot of people's families are here. That is mostly a treasure. Mostly, I say. And I say mostly because I recognize that we have mixed feelings about what is called our families of origin. Sometimes we enjoy deep and fruitful connections with our button sewers. Sometimes we wish we were closer to them for the times when our threads come loose and we feel only they know how to fix it. I thought if I touched this place, the brokenness inside me might start healing. But sometimes, right, we feel grateful for the distance we might have or wish we had more, that in our own space we can flourish in ways we cannot when we are too close to our beginnings. Families of origin are full of life. They can be sites of love and caring, a deep and abiding affection for one another. They can be sites of fear or pain, the memories of abuse to self and other. They can be sites of learning and inspiration. They can be sites of longing, a wish for more, a grief for what has passed away, baggage, memories, identity. They are always, whether we like it or not, sites of meaning. Okay, so how can we live with and in and from our families, both our families of origin and the families we build ourselves? Given the mixed legacies we have been left, how do we leave good legacies, or at least as well as we can, for those who might call us their family of origin someday? We spend more emotional and spiritual energy on families than almost everything else that we do. So liberal religion ought to have something useful to say. Here's what I got. I perform a lot of weddings. I've sat through many toasts, some awkward and some moving. I've seen couples who have given the wedding a lot of thought and the marriage very little, and vice versa. I've met a lot of in-laws. And when I meet people's parents, I often say to myself, "Oh, I see." I can so easily imagine being in Bruce Marshall's shoes to see that this 12-year-old girl will be making this family work. It is to her that it matters most, and that his professionalism in keeping it not be a farce counts. It is to her that it needs to be serious. I have a rule about parenting and in ministry and life in general, which I try to remember and sometimes succeed and sometimes fail, but I try. The rule is this: it's not about me. It's not about me. I remember that when I'm about to get in a power struggle with one of my kids. It's not about me. I don't know how widely this expression is shared in the world. I have also heard that expression: "I raised you, you owe me." You ever heard that one? I think this sentiment is a mistake. Children are not playthings for adults. They are not our property. We are our grandmother's prayers and our grandfather's dreamings, the breath of our ancestors. But that is how it should be. This is another way of saying that history ought to be an inheritance and not a debt, a gift and not an obligation. When one hands down and another takes up the heritage of mind and heart, that ought to be a gift, a ship that crosses the gulf of generations. And it's my hope that that ship is carefully loaded with love and not with guilt or anger or fear. History ought to be an inheritance and not a debt. Each person has a unique destiny, a power and a spirit inside them, a mission in the world, a love in their heart. And the job of those of us who sew the buttons on is to create buttons, strong buttons to help our children get through windy, wintry days, functional buttons which can be undone on hot summer days, to sew, if you will, a coat of many colors and not a straitjacket. And if we find that our families of origin have sewed us buttons that do not work, that are too tight or too loose, well, it might be time to try as best we can to take off that cloak and hang it back up in the closet, pick up another. This happens more often than you might think. Maybe our partners or our friends might let us use one of theirs. I've been reading the Harry Potter books to my kids. Leo will sit, and he's five, and just listen. So great to pass along to the next generation. Harry, as most of you know, the story, I'm sure, is more or less an orphan raised by his aunt and uncle who don't really want him. They're straight out of a Dickens novel. It's classic. For Christmas one year, he gets a toothpick. That's his only gift. But Harry makes a friend on his first day of wizard school, Ron Weasley, who has five older brothers and one younger sister. And every member of the family receives a knit sweater with their initial on it each Christmas. And that first Christmas, Harry gets one too. His first loving Christmas present from a family. Over time, Harry's family becomes Ron's family. Ron's family becomes Harry's. This kind of thing happens, right? We can get some new buttons. The old ones never really leave us, but the new ones can give us the freedom to become ourselves in ways the old ones could never do. In the 1950s and after, gay and lesbian people developed secret codes and expressions to identify each other. Friends of Dorothy was one you might have heard of, but the main one that was used was family. Are they in the family? People would say, we are family. Because sometimes you need to make a new one. Thankfully, that is changing as more and more folks get to keep the ones they have and add to it rather than replace. That's a sign of progress. Whether we add the buttons of another family to our collection or not, we're still faced with the task of making the most of the hand we are dealt, the family of origin we have. This is good practice for us, for we have no power to choose where and when we are born. And this is the first in a long line of things over which we have no power. It seems to me that we ought to begin as much we can with loving our family members for who they are. We can spend all our energy trying to get them to change. God knows sometimes we do, but that is a tree that will bear no fruit. Loving people for who they are means warts and all. It means seeing their histories and their context, that a man raised in a certain generation is not likely to become Mr. Touchy-feely. Don't hold your breath. The parent raised with an alcoholic mother has done pretty well, considering. Maybe you ought to cut her a little slack. Loving people for who they are, even if they have died years ago, loving them for who they are is a difficult task. Sometimes it's more than we can do, but we can keep working on it. The other side of that coin is that we need to insist that our families of origin, them that sewed them on, love us for who we are, that they respect our choices, our faith, our families. It will be harder to do this, by the way, if we can't love ourselves for who we are, these tasks, of course, being closely intertwined. The joke about loving your neighbor as yourself is that most of us do. We just don't love ourselves very much, so no wonder the neighbor gets it bad. For families, you can double that or triple it. We have to love ourselves. If our families treat us without respect, we have to say, this isn't okay. It's entirely appropriate for us to set firm boundaries, to set them and to keep them. It'll be hardest the first time, and then it will get easier. Trust me. Love for ourselves and a proper sense of our own dignity demand that we do so. It might free somebody else in the family system, too, while we're at it. And when our families do love us for who we are, when they encourage us to reach for the stars and be our best self, we should say, thank you, and return the favor. History should be an inheritance, not a debt. We have some power over that. Rifling through the old family files, we will find both debts and gifts, and we can choose on which to focus. Some debts will have to be paid, amends made, things repaired, but others can be written off, no longer owed. Enough time has passed. The gifts, the grace, the stories, and the hopes, those can continue in us. We can choose to love our sowers, to love ourselves, to move forward with gratitude and hope. This is the good news of liberal religion. Yes, some things are given to us. We have no choice on that. We have no choice, but we have a chance. A chance to find beauty and wisdom wherever we find ourselves. For there is beauty and wisdom everywhere and in everyone, if we have eyes to see and ears to hear. We have a chance to stand up for ourselves, to insist on dignity and integrity, since all people deserve dignity. It begins there. Our dreams for the world of peace and freedom, it begins with how we treat ourselves and the people in the room with us with dignity. We have a chance to love without hope of reward, not because we think we're going to get something, but because love feels good. And it is the best way to live. We can love without hope or reward as we are loved without judgment by what is holy and wondrous ourselves. And we have a chance to begin anew. New life is always springing up in us. It's always a new day to begin a new way of living and build a new world, always springing up and around us. May love and hope guide our ways. And our families, near and far, given and chosen, may love and hope guide our way. The world that we share together, in joy and in sorrow, may love and hope guide our way. Amen and blessed be. Let's sing together. For all that is our life, I invite you to rise in body or spirit. Please be seated. So good to be with you in worship this morning. If you are new with us today, I hope that you checked in with Belle at the Welcome Desk to find out more about the programs and activities of this church, which are many. Lots of things coming up, and there are announcements in your bulletin about activities and other things to look forward to. We are selling tickets for our fundraiser with the Second City Comedy Troupes. Their traveling company is performing here in this sanctuary. So there are only 200 tickets, and they're beginning to sell. So get yours. Great holiday gift to give to somebody or to bring somebody to. And Belle can sell you those tickets after the service. That's on March the 4th. In a moment, we'll take up an offering to support the work of this church and the work of mercy and justice and hope in the world. This week, we're collecting for the Rockford Promise, an effort to provide scholarship funds to make college affordable for every student who graduates from the Rockford Public Schools. They are starting small. I joined the board of Rockford Promise this summer, and I'm impressed with their dedication to the work that is required to make this happen. And we hope to give a few scholarships this spring, so students who live in the Ellis Heights neighborhood and the Midtown neighborhood, a few students from each can afford to attend Rockford University or Rock Valley College. So all the money you give today will go to support the scholarships for individual students in our community. Hope you can be generous. And next week, I'll be preaching more about ancestry and thinking about migration, immigration, those stories of journey and travel. We're talking about the justice questions at stake as we confront this issue again as a country. What shall we do with those who are here and those who wish to be here? What about our own stories of coming here or family stories if we know them or have them? So come along and invite somebody to come with you and hear about our message of justice and mercy in the world. That's next week. An offering will now be given and received. I will extinguish our chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These things we carry with us until we are together again. While I do that, I invite you to rise in body or spirit, join hands, or stand next to the person next to you for our blessings and benedictions. Frederick Gillis said, "May the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, which reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us, now and always." May it be so. We'll sing together our closing blessing. We'll sing it through twice.